sweeping to use it as a garnish, damaged like the leg he's limping to the barn with. That's Earl Sweatshirt. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. The Toronto Blue Jays have finally swept the team this year. They swept the Chicago White Sox on Wednesday, a 3-1 victory. That is their first sweep of the 2024 season here on May 30th. It didn't come without damage, though. Alek Manoah, potentially budding as one of the kind of feel-good stories of this season so far, left the game in the second inning with right elbow discomfort. I don't think it was that he was uncomfortable with how good his elbow felt. He said to Shai Davidi and other reporters in Chicago that he felt a pinchy sensation. It's something that he had felt in the Detroit start as well, but in a bullpen session between starts, it felt more or less fine. So he gave it a go yesterday. To hear, I'm paraphrasing him describing it, but it was pinchy when he would get full extension. So he was holding a little bit something back early on. And then on that one pitch, he felt he had to, you know, really let it go, really let the elbow extend. And then you could see kind of hopped off the mound. And then immediately everyone seemed to know Alejandro Kirk quick out to the mound, John Schneider quick out of the bullpen. So we'll see. Alek Manoah is set for an MRI back here in Toronto today. The Blue Jays are off, so they'll get an off day to, you know, deal with this, work through possible contingencies, get the other starters a rest day. But this is not going to be one of those scenarios like a couple weeks ago where we're going through the potential, well, they could, you know, use this off day, use that off day. They could go with four guys. There's a bullpen day here. That is not going to be remotely the case this time around. They have, starting tomorrow, 36 games in 38 days. You're going to need a fifth starter, or you're going to need some sort of plan there. Let's work through it. Joined in studio for the hour here by Arden Zwelling of Sportsnet, of sportsnet.ca. How we doing, buddy?
What's going on, man? Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
The lyric that you begin the show with, what's your process there? Does that come quick? Like, do you just know it the night before, or do you have to search?
I would say like three quarters of them. I have thought of them already, or like if I'm like, I have my music on when I'm like working out or walking around or whatever, and a lyric comes to me, I'm like, oh, that might be useful. I'll jot it in a notes app in my phone. So I have a notes app in my phone with like a bunch of potential ones. And then, you know, this one, I was like, okay, I have made a mental note of like, you know, words like sweep and things like that, right? So I have to double check.
I'm like, you got out in there. You got one of those.
There are a few complete. Like that. You know, there are like, I've got like a half dozen about like raining and stuff. Like when there's a rain delay, like, those ones are easy to fire up. And then sometimes they're just like sometimes they're going to be convoluted and not like they're going to be such a reach. It's 162 games. I'm not going to have 162 good.
Jays play the Orioles next week, and say they lose 2-1, totally unremarkable game. No one does anything spectacular. Yeah. What are you doing on that day?
I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see how I feel.
Are you finding like the name of like an Oriole and putting in lyrics into Google?
Yeah. I mean, I kicked around, like we kicked around with Mike Petriello yesterday, Jackson Holiday in Cambodia joke, which is a Dead Kennedy song, Holiday in Cambodia. You can do little stuff like that. You can figure it out. I haven't run into it that much yet, but this is also like, I don't know, we're only 2 months into the season. There's a lot of, and like, I've used my best rain delay stuff already. I've used my best, hey, someone got injured in a sweep lyric one now.
You got to have an Elvis one teed up.
Yeah.
You know, this September.
Yeah, there will be.
That's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
One way or the other.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. Even like, I don't know, when they got rain delayed in Baltimore the other week, like there's a song called Raining in Baltimore by Counting Crows. Like some of these, they just present themselves to you. You know, Chicago is a team and a city where there are lots of lyrics about that. Less so maybe, you know, in a Pittsburgh Pirates series. So we'll see tomorrow. Come Monday.
I was curious.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to get to the bottom of that.
Yeah, it's a silly thing,
like,
but
it.
I have
great.
A lot of hours to fill, man.
Yeah, I like it.
Okay, so Jay Sweep.
Yep.
We'll talk about some of the Alek Manoah stuff and some of the potential contingencies. Obviously not the best weekend down in Detroit. I know you weren't there, but they dropped 3-4 to Detroit. We had all kind of talked about, oh, they've got this two-week stretch. So they're sitting at 6-4 right now. They'd have to sweep the Pirates to get back to 500. Big picture, how are you feeling about where the Blue Jays are at right now, 26-29?
Well, not that different than I felt like going into this stretch.
Okay.
Because you should sweep the White Sox. And really, it's 5-1 against the White Sox, right? Because you add in the three prior to it. So, they're doing what they should be doing. Like, I would bet you that the Fangraphs playoff odds didn't move that much in the last 3 days.
Because they assume you're going to beat the White Sox.
It's baked in, right? Zips, Steamer, like, objectively, the Blue Jays should beat the White Sox, who are just a tough watch in all facets, right? Like, defensively, very little effort there. A lineup where you're just not worried about anybody who's coming to the plate. A pitching staff that, you know, what Josh Donaldson say, it's some good hitting, right?
Yeah.
So, like, I'm not surprised that the Blue Jays have performed well over the last week. So it just hasn't changed, like, my feeling about the team, really. Ultimately, for the Blue Jays to, like, up those playoff projections, they're going to have to beat good teams. Like, they're going to have to do it against Baltimore and against the Mariners and against the Guardians. Like, that's where they make up the ground that they need to make up.
Yeah, and, I mean, we can look at it's yesterday was the exact one-third mark of the season. So even though it's a little early maybe to look at playoff odds, it is, like, a tidy checkpoint. We're at the one-third mark. So Fangraphs has two different versions of their projections from here. One of them has the Blue Jays at 20.7%. That's the, if you go to their like playoff odds page, that's not very good. That is a 1 in 5 chance. That is like almost 40 percentage points lower than what it started the season at. There's also Dan Zaborski does a one that is based purely on zips from here. It has the Jays finishing at 83 wins, so getting back past 500 in a little bit. But even then, and part of why this is going to sound high to some people, I think they have a 33% chance by those odds, but it's largely informed by the fact that zips is believing what the Tampa Bay Rays have showed us so far, that they're better than the Jays in the standings, but they don't project to improve as much as the Jays do. And also the AL West is way weaker than we thought. So maybe that, you know, second wild card, third wild card is more of a potential there given the weakness of the AL West. But it's still, either way, it's not very good to be sitting on 20% or 33% or 50%, honestly, at this point in the season.
Well, and projection systems just have never come around on the Orioles.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's gone a bit better than, like, you know, they won 100 plus games last year and projection systems saw them as like a 500 team, yeah, or something.
They're slowly getting there because now these young players have sampled. Like, part of the issue was, like, any rookie that comes up and performs really well, like Adley Rutschman 2 years ago, Gunnar Henderson this year, they're still regressing them because they're like, well, young guys aren't this good. Like, they'll come back down to league average a little bit. The projection systems can't know that, like, well, this guy was a number one pick and has, like, everyone believes it. Like, there's an eye test component of, yeah, of course Gunnar's going to be an MVP candidate. Like, so they kind of have to regress those guys back, I guess. But yeah, eventually they'll catch up and be like, yeah, the Orioles are good.
Well, and the game's changing, right? Yeah. Like, fastballs are harder than ever. Aging curves are kind of accelerating in a way. I think the prime for a player has shifted earlier in their career than where it was, like, when a lot of this historical data was set. Like, we're seeing fewer and fewer guys in their mid-30s to late-30s, some on the Blue Jays, but you wouldn't know that watching the Jays, but fewer and fewer guys hanging around late into their career. So that is, like, skewing things a little bit. But, like, I know people roll their eyes when we talk about playoff odds. You know, what is that worth? Like, it's just a number, whatever. But, like, people in front offices, like, have told me directly, like, we use playoff odds to inform our decision making.
Right.
And they have their own internal proprietary ones, but I've also been told that they're not that different than what's publicly available. It might be, if the Blue Jays are at 20 right now, internally they might be like 22 to 24 or something, but it's not going to be like internally they're 50. So as long as the Blue Jays are around 20, if they go into July like that, they're selling. Like, that's it. They need to improve those playoff odds up to, like you said, at least to 50, and then you kind of go from there. But that's going to inform how they behave going into the trade deadline.
Yeah, and it's not like an analytics thing necessarily. Like, we're trying to quantify it, but it's the same as, you know, take the numbers out of it. If you're sitting 3 games back of 500 and you're 4 games back of the final wild card and you got 5 teams to jump, like, we could sit here without the numbers and be like, that's a bad spot to be in. Is it worth buying? Is it better to sell? And then they can just see, well, you know, maybe there's a 1 in 5 shot that we're going to make it back and make the playoffs. What is that worth to us? How does that change our accounting? So yeah, it's a fair point. We've heard, you know, Alex Anthopoulos has spoken, and he didn't say specifically about the playoff odds, but he talked to Blair and Barker last week, I think, about that 2015 team, and why, you know, a team that was standings wise very similar to this Blue Jays team, why they decided that that was worth going in. And part of it was, well, our run differential was astronomical, which will inform projection systems and things like that. And they had a boatload of games left against division opponents. So there was more possibility to make up ground. This is also in the system where you played a division opponent 19 times instead of 13. So, you know, as much as that hurts when you're in the AL East, it is opportunity to make up ground. So, yeah, when we mention that stuff, it does inform. Front offices are looking at it. And yeah, I mean, I guess it's a little early for this still, but you definitely see on MLB Network and things like that. The vultures are already starting to circle in the event the Blue Jays do. I mean, I'd imagine it would be a more minor sell than some of these segments are imagining. But yeah, like it is a real possibility, right?
Yeah. And I like the Blue Jays, if they do get to that point, they're not going to tear this thing down. Like it's going to be a reset, pivot, refresh, whatever the like vogue vernacular is these days.
Retool. Among
retool.
For 2025 is, I believe, what the buzz term will be.
The Jays PR department's already, getting these sorted out for what Ross Atkins is going to say after the trade deadline if things continue going the way that they are. But yeah, I haven't, like, in no conversation that I've had with people who are actually making these decisions, have I gotten the sense that the Blue Jays are going to trade Vladimir Guerrero Jr. or Bo Bichette at this trade deadline if they're out of it and if they're selling. It would be a soft sell. Be anybody who's coming off the books at the end of this year, obviously you're going to try to recoup some value there. Like the Blue Jays are not going to Colorado Rockies this, you know, they're not going to like, just like, see, maybe we re-sign Jimmy Garcia in the last 2 months. You know, maybe we Daniel Bard him. It's not going
to
happen.
Clutch to Ryan McMahon. Like he's the greatest Colorado Rocky of all time.
That's the thing. Like I've also been told, like, if you call the Rockies and ask about Ryan McMahon, they hang up the phone. Like, they won't even talk about him. Like, their owner loves him. They think he's a really important part of what they're trying to do. If you can surmise what they're trying to do, like, I mean, 29 other front offices are trying to surmise that, but they won't even talk about Ryan McMahon. They don't want to hear names. They don't want to hear proposals. So the Blue Jays, you can talk to about Bo Bichette. You could talk to about Vladimir Guerrero Jr., but, like, in any transaction, whether it's a trade, a signing, a waiver claim, the Blue Jays, internally, like, they must be gaining value. Like, they will not lose value in any transaction. That is just a rule that they have, a belief that they have. You can agree with it, you can disagree with it, but that's why you never see them, like, pay a premium early in the season in a trade. They need to see more value coming their way than is going out. So you think about the value of Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. as borderline superstars, and stars at least, in their primes next year, contributing to a 2025 club that the Blue Jays want to be competitive and want to compete for the postseason. And I'm sure they hope for an AL East title. We'll see how realistic that is. But their value contributing to that team is pretty high. Mm-hmm. So anyone who's trying to acquire them would need to exceed that value in what's coming back. It narrows the possibilities for those guys to be traded.
Yeah, and Bo is also like extremely affordable next year on the extension that they worked out. Vlad, through the ARB process, will be very well paid for, he's not going to be on a 10-year, $300 million contract, but like he's already making $20 million and has another ARB year left. Like
he'll make 25 next year.
Yeah, he's going to be near the very top of the ARB scale that we've seen historically. So there's some, you know, surplus value there. But yeah, there's value in the player. There's value in the, I'm going to use their term, optionality of having different pathways next year and things like that. And then just the flexibility to, hey, we could win again in 2025. We could retool up. You'd be, if you intend to contend in 2025, which they do because they do generally, but they also just poured $400 million of renovations in and have the fancy suites to fill and stuff like that. Like this is, you don't want necessarily the bottom line dictating your baseball strategy, but I can't imagine there's a big appetite for a full teardown when you've just invested so much also.
You're going to hear a lot of discussion around it over the next 2 months. Like if things continue going the way they are, if the Blue Jays go on a run here, obviously, I mean, it's a different discussion, but if they stay where they're at, yeah, you're going to hear a lot of rumors. You're going to hear a lot of speculation. You're going to hear people from other front offices like floating to insiders. Like,
we've already started to hear it.
Yeah.
Like Mark Feinsand of MLB.com. He wasn't like reporting the Jays are shopping them, but he did say like teams have called and the ask is astronomical, but to your point, they didn't hang up the phone. And the Rockies do. I'm not sure the Rockies, like you could tell me like, yeah, they don't have internet. So someone tried to email them. like this is when people get mad about analytics and things like that. Like I can understand some of the frustrations, but we know how much each team roughly invests in this kind of stuff. And it's like the Dodgers way at the tippy top, 27 teams all trying to, you know, use the same information, get an edge. And then there's the White Sox and the Rockies way down at the bottom all the time. And you might want to change the mix of analytics and eye tests or whatever, but I promise you, you don't want to be the Rockies and the White Sox down at the very bottom.
You could put the Yankees up at the top in terms of just sheer spending on R&D. Houston, Tampa Bay, for as little as they spend on player payroll, it's like it's extreme what they spend on R&D and what they spend on analysts and stuff, because like there's so much more value there when it's just like another $80,000 for a salary for some computer engineering grad who didn't want to go and work at IBM or wherever and just loved baseball and was willing to grind away, right? And just like loved pouring into this stuff. That, there's so much more value there if that guy can find you Isak Paredes, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, who's, I'm forgetting his name. Who's the outfielder they got?
Caminero?
No, from the Dodgers in the Glasnow deal. He had a great series against the Jays.
Palacios?
No, the, look up their roster resource. I'm just blanking on his name.
Johnny DeLuca.
Yeah, DeLuca.
Okay.
Great player.
Their roster resource page is nothing but like traded in the last.
It's all those guys.
So Palacios was St. Louis. My bad.
DeLuca came over in the Glasnow Margot deal, and he's just like the classic undervalued, like toolsy outfielder who they put into a platoon and they put him into his spots where, you know, they play to his strengths. And he's got a big arm and he's fast and he's got sneaky pop and great contact, doesn't strike out a lot, takes his walks. Like you saw it in that series at Rogers Center when the Rays were here. Like, he's just such a classic Rays ad, and he's going to give them a ton of value for 2 to 3 years until they trade him in, like, 2027.
Yeah.
That's until he's Manny Margot going out in another deal and some other guy's coming back.
And then two Johnnies DeLuca come back. And and this, I mean, honestly, through this lens, the Rays are fascinating this year because they are, you know, they're better than, they're a half game better than the Jays right now. But in terms of projecting them forward, like, the projections and systems and things don't like them quite as much. They would know that. They also, like, you know, the Jays have underperformed, and you can expect guys to, you know, perform more to their career levels. But like, guys who underwent Tommy John surgery are not going to normalize this year, right? Like, those guys are done. Yeah. So the Rays, you know, maybe could be convinced a little more firmly, hey, this is a sell year. And like, the Rays as a seller is fascinating because they always win. Like it is very rare for them to look back at the Baseball Reference transaction log 2-3 years after a deal, and the Rays have not won.
And that's from the way that they scout, the way that they use models to inform their decision making. That's from like them buying into the data and having like a really clear process. And like, I know analytics is like the boogeyman, but like, to your point, the Rays, the Astros, the Dodgers, the Yankees, like these are the teams that have invested the most into it and have like utilized it the most in their decision making, and also just so happen to be the most successful teams over the last like decade. Like, it's not, you know, it's not just a short sample of the Yankees and Astros being good or the Rays and Dodgers being good. Like, these are the teams that win over and over again. Now, the Yankees and Dodgers, they like supplement that by spending like crazy on player payroll.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, that's the ideal, right? Yeah. It's like, you are a very high spending team that can spend, and that power goes toward like, keeping your farm system stock, you're drafting and developing well, you're identifying those guys, you are winning. You know, when the Dodgers have to, every spring training, they've got too many guys for their 40 man and they have to turn a 40 man guy into a non 40 man guy. Eventually that guy becomes something, you know, like even the Mitch White trade, right? Where like, we'll see DeJesus, who knows, and the Mitch White side of it didn't work out, and Nick Ferrasso's been injured all year. But like, that kind of thing is like, well, we could DFA Mitch White, or we could try to find a trade and Nick Ferrasso suddenly looks good for half a season, you know, moving back to a starting role for them. That kind of thing where, you are also spending on Shohei Ohtani and Yamamoto and guys like that. But the way that you sustain being competitive for years and years and years is not just spending. It's having that pipeline of inexpensive talents you can spend on those guys, having trade-worthy talent so that you can continue to bring guys in on the pitching side.
Well, that's the reason why like so many veteran players continue to go to like teams like the Dodgers and Yankees and have these like dead cat bounces at the end of their careers, where all of a sudden they have these resurgences. That is partially analytics as well, because like, these teams are very good at advanced scouting. They're very good at picking up pitch tips, picking up tendencies. They use models for this stuff. Like, they have algorithms. They use like computer learning, like AI, in order to find like your tendencies and what you're doing on the mound that can give away tells. Like, we've seen the Yankees like doing this pretty brazenly at Rogers Center not that long ago. It's like well known throughout the game that they are as good as anyone at that, and it's because of how they've invested in it, and it continues to give them edges. So that's why you see like a lot of veteran players who seem like they're cooked or seem like they're on the downturn all of a sudden have resurgences with these kind of franchises. And they, you know, like when Andrew Friedman acquires Justin Turner at the deadline this year and chucks him on his bench, like, don't be surprised. Yeah. When he's coming up with like huge hits for the Dodgers in August, September, and potentially even into October.
And this is why when you look at the average age of a team and you weight it by playing time and things like that, for the Jays, it's a negative. They're the fifth oldest team. They're 30th in bat speed. You know, their guys who are over 30 are like bottom five in the league in terms of over 30 production. And then a team like the Dodgers is the oldest team in the league, and they're just fine. They're scoring a whole run a game extra over the Blue Jays. Or the Phillies, who weighed out as like the same age and are scoring like a run and a quarter more a game than the Blue Jays. It's like some of that is like, yeah, they're young guys also. But yeah, they found a way to either identify the older guys who still have something left or get the best out of them.
If Giancarlo Stanton's still a Marlin, he might be out of the game. But he's a Yankee, and they're really good at putting him in positions to succeed and giving him the information that helps him succeed at the highest level. So he's having the season that he's having.
All right. This was not the discussion I thought we would have. So let's put a pin in it for, let's take a break. And then when we come back, we'll go through the Alek Manoah scenarios, take a look at who's maybe ready on the IL in AAA, maybe even a little further down the minors. What a, you know, cobbling together the Trevor Richards plan would look like again this year. We'll also take a look at some of the Blue Jays bullpen struggles. Arden Swelling staying with us as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's The Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, Arden Zwelling of Sportsnet, of Sportsnet.ca. Still with me. Second hour of the show, we're going to talk to Peter Flaherty. He's a national writer and analyst at Baseball America. The NCAA tournament starts tomorrow, so big time for college baseball leading into that mid-July draft. I don't know how much, you know, it's always interesting coming from basketball to baseball where the draft is a huge thing in basketball. Don't know what your guys' appetite is for it, but we'll see. We'll talk about a couple interesting teams heavy on Canadians in the regional field as well. And then, you know, one or two Canadians. If you look at the top Canadians for the 2024 draft, it is heavy on prep guys, like high school age guys, but there are a couple interesting NCAA names. So we'll kick that around. We'll talk to pitching analyst Lance Brzdowski. We'll also answer a bunch of your texts. So you can text us 590-590. You know, what do you think of the City Connect leaks? What would you, you know, assuming Alek Manoah is out for a little bit here, what is your preferred succession plan? Any names in the minors that you're eager to get a look at or to have us dive deeper on? Let us know. Text us to 590-590. Like I said, Arden Zwelling still alongside me. Arden, so we don't know Alek Manoah is going to undergo an MRI today. There are, when you have a pinchy feeling in your elbow, there are a number of ways it could go. Some of them are pretty bad. Before we get into contingencies that flow from this, Alek Manoah sounded pretty beat up talking about this last night, and you could understand why. It's been a long road back. As he said, I've dealt with a lot of expletive to get back to this point. And, you know, he was talking as if he knows he's hurt. And whether it's hurt or injured, whether it's medium term or long term, we got to work through the potential here that Alek Manoah could miss a bunch of time. At the, you know, personal level and Alek Manoah level, what had you been making of how he looked since he came back and where he was at?
Well, just on the first piece, like, I think he knew he wasn't right going into it.
Right.
And he alluded to that afterwards. John Schneider alluded to that. And you can even just see, like, as that outing was going, like, the velo was ticking down. And even just, like, qualitatively, it looked like he wasn't really letting it loose. And it looked like he wasn't super confident in his extension, in his release. Saw a little bit of him kind of like making, you know, gripping and making a fist, which is like always a huge red flag when a pitcher's doing that. So, you know, we're not orthopedists. You know, we'll see. He might not have even had his MRI yet. He might be sitting in the waiting room right now watching us on mute on a TV.
I doubt it.
But you never know. So we'll see. Like you said, there's a wide range of outcomes here, right? And obviously the hope is that it's on the, you know, the better side. It could be treated conservatively. And then obviously there's some nightmare outcomes and there's all kinds of stuff in between. who knows? We'll see what we learn tomorrow. But just like, yeah, as far as what he had done to get to this point this year, like a lot, as he said, like this is a guy who has, you know, been on this odyssey, this saga for what, 18 months now, essentially, of ups and downs and trying to relearn his mechanics and changing his body and, you know, up and down to the minors and a whole ton of like mental strife and all the pressure and anxiety that comes along with that. Like it hasn't been easy. And it hasn't been easy for him to find consistency even this year, right? It's been a little bit up and down. He had those two like masterful outings, then the other two weren't as great, but there was so much to kind of build off of. Remember when he threw his first outing and we talked, right? And
yeah,
it was like, yeah, you know, gave up, you know, a really bad homer and, you know, left some pitches in some bad spots, but like some really encouraging stuff here, right? And the stuff was back. Just
yeah,
the
slider had been ticking in the right direction, like movement wise.
Yeah. So you know, it's you know, there's no other way to put it. Like it's tough, and you feel for him, and you're just hoping that he gets good news.
So let's play out a scenario where we don't have to doomsday it, but let's say it's going to be a little bit here, right? Like he's going to need an IL stint. I think that seems like probably a reasonable assumption at this point. I mentioned it. Tomorrow starts a stretch of 36 games in 38 days. For the Blue Jays, they have two off days over the next like 6 weeks, basically. So you are not going to be able to do the four-man rotation thing. You're probably not going to be able to do the we'll do a bullpen day every 5 days, because even carrying a ninth relief arm, that's so much stress on your bullpen and so much stress on your four main starters. Should be said, Trevor Richards last night, unbelievable again, comes in unexpectedly, 3 1/3 inning, only 2 base runners, didn't strike anyone out, but he was just like, here it is in the zone, fastball changeup, roll over it, over and over and over again. Man, we really can't say enough about the utility and versatility Trevor Richards has provided this team the last couple of years.
Well, that's Trevor, right? Like I was talking to him on the last homestand because he had just quietly like strung together these 7 really strong outings where he hadn't allowed a hit or a walk or a run. I mean, it had just been like near perfect over like 7 straight outings. Nobody'd really noticed. And I was like, dude, like, what's going well for you right now? Like, how are you doing this? He's like, changeup's working. I was like, okay, but you know, like the changeup's the ultimate field pitch, you know, like yeah. How do you get it working? Like, how do you get it to the point that it's at? He's like, I just throw it every day. I was like, do you have it quickly when you come in onto the mound? It's like, I don't know. I just kind of go out and throw it. Like, that's just the guy that he is, right? That's why last night he can go from like sipping a coffee in a hoodie to the phone ringing. Hey, Trev, we need you on the mound in 45 seconds into a game at like the highest level. Obviously, like the, you know, quality of opposition. He's not facing the Yankees here, the Dodgers. But like, he's still got to go into a big league game and execute and throw really hard pitches and like, what didn't even seem like one of those situations where he took forever on the mound to warm up. Like, seemed like he was pretty ready to go quickly and then just started churning through outs. Like, that's who he is as a guy, just that mentality. Like, he's very low-key, easygoing, even-keeled. Like, I will do whatever, pitch whenever. Like, I am just, you know, happy to go on the mound and do what I do. So I think that contributes.
Yeah, not the most valuable for us when we're trying to learn a little bit more about, hey, the shape of your changeup has changed. It looks like you're throwing it differently. And the answer is, I don't know, or I'm not telling you, but it's very valuable for the Blue Jays.
I asked him about that too. I was like, you're throwing your changeup slower and more in the zone. Like, why'd you do that? I don't know.
Like, all right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
I don't fully believe you that you don't know. I think you're aware, but you know, sometimes guys don't want to give stuff away. Sometimes guys also just like, you know, don't know how to verbalize it, right? Like I think David Lorela of FanGraphs a couple years ago was talking to a bunch of hitters about like, what do you actually look for? Like, there's obviously the old, you know, the old mentality of like, oh, if the ball looks white, it's a fastball. If you see the red dot, it's a curveball based on the spin or whatever. That's an oversimplification. And then Mookie Betts was basically like, I know what I'm looking for, but I can't, like, I don't have the vocabulary to tell you what I'm looking for. It's so just like brain chunking.
He's recognizing patterns.
Yeah.
Really.
And it's probably the same for some pitchers of like, I know the feel. I know what it feels like out of my hand. I know what my arm feels like, but I can't describe to you what I'm doing or how I'm getting that extra ride on the changeup today.
I mean, when's the last time you saw Trevor Richards shake on a mound, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's just like, yeah, whatever you call, like, I'm going to execute that to the best of my ability. And like, he's going to give up his homers, right? He's going to walk some guys. He hasn't done that as much this year, which has been huge for him. Like, when he really got into trouble in prior seasons was when he was just walking too many guys, just too inconsistent with his own. Throwing his stuff on the plate more this year and having success. So, like, yeah, huge boon for the Blue Jays. Might be starting games for the Blue Jays going forward.
Yeah, and he gave them 3-plus innings yesterday. He only threw 37 pitches. The White Sox did him a huge favor in, like, we're just going to we're just going to chop at it. Like, that's not a well-disciplined team. It's not a good hitting team. He has thrown 38 pitches this year. I think it is, he threw 38 yesterday. He had thrown 37 against Detroit not that long ago as well. So he's stretched out to, let's say, 40. Maybe you could even push him to 50.
He threw like 50 in an outing last year, I remember, right? When he was in that rotation spot. So it's possible.
Yeah. But I don't know that you want to go too far past that. Yeah. I should also say, too, it's like Trevor Richards is a more valuable pitcher than the surface level stats say. Like, his ERA ended up almost 5 last year. Some of that, like, his expected ERA based on all the metrics we have was like around 3.5. But also, like, when you are bouncing around roles like this, when the team is using you in situations that are not optimal for you, we do have to sometimes take a reliever's ERA with a grain of salt because, like, yeah, Trevor Richards, if he was only being deployed in situations that are good for Trevor Richards, probably would have had an ERA like I'd run lower. He wouldn't have been asked to give them 3 innings here and there. I just wanted to acknowledge that because he has been so valuable for this team. Now, he got up as high as 65 last year. That game at Texas, he gave that was only a 3 inning stint, but they let him go to 65.
That's wild.
So maybe they'll...
reliever who you can just get up to 65. Like, it's so valuable, right? And it's, you know, runners on, it's late in games, it's early in games, it's with short notice, with a ton of notice, it's righties, it's lefties, it's uppercut swings, it's flat swings, like, it's everything. Like, you just use them in any situation. It's such an asset to have. So, yeah, look, if you are without Alek Manoah going forward, I would expect, like, plan A for now with the 5th spot will be Trevor Richards ahead of Bowden Francis. Okay. And then once Yariel Rodriguez is healthy, you can kind of think about what you have to do there. Like, a really interesting variable is, where's Chris Bassitt at? And what's, like, he going to be capable of his next time out? Because it sounded like this last time, like, they weren't sure he was going to make it onto the mound. And then when he did, he was thinking, I might only face one hitter and have to come out. So it's going to, his health and readiness is going to be a big variable here.
And Shai Davidi provided a note in his write-up from last night's game that in between starts here, Bassitt has been basically getting treatment around the clock. Like, he has stuff on his neck to try to alleviate the issue. I think he pretty narrowly avoided an IL stint there. And there was even a scenario where, like, say everyone was healthy. I know he's listed as the probable for Sunday, but you could have used that off day to buy Bassitt a couple extra days. And hey, you know, Manoah, you're moving up a day. Kikuchi, you know, your next one's moving up. You're not getting the benefit of that extra day off. They can't do that now. And the way this is, like, you could... let's say the strategy for this first one is Richards is going to start and Bowden Francis is going to come behind him as the piggyback. And Bowden Francis, by the way, got up to 60 pitches in his last Buffalo outing. So he is stretched out, not full starter stretched out, but he started the season as a starter. He threw 60 pitches the other day. We can probably clock Bowden Francis in for a Bowden Francis workload. Would you give any consideration, or is this getting too cute? You play the Orioles next week at home. Bump Bassitt a day so that bullpen day is against a much weaker hitting Pirates team?
Yeah, I mean, we saw them bump Bassitt like earlier this year, and like, he's pretty flexible in his routines and able to, you know, withstand that. Like, I think it'll all just come down to how he's feeling and what's best for him physically. They're going to try to get him through here without an IL stint. They did something similar last year when he was battling some similar back stuff and not feeling his best. And they were able to kind of get him through then. So done it before, but you know, this is a different issue. And it seems like it can be a little bit sporadic in terms of like the intensity of this issue, right? Like, just listening to his comments, like, feels like he kind of woke up on start day feeling a lot different than he did the day prior. So much of this is going to depend on just how he's feeling day to day, how he responds to treatment, maybe even what he's able to do in between outings. I can't imagine he's throwing bullpens in between his starts right now. So it's going to be a touch and go scenario. Like you said, it's 36 and 38.
Yeah.
So
starting tomorrow,
it's going to be interesting. You know, there's not a lot of starting pitching depth there for the Blue Jays.
No. So let's play that out. So obviously you don't want to do the Richards Bowden Francis piggyback permanently. You don't want to do it for the whole month. And Yariel Rodriguez got up to, I believe, 36 pitches in his last AAA start. He's going to throw again on Sunday. On Friday rather. He's a couple, you could probably call him up for the bullpen now, but he's a couple stints still away from being a starter. What would your appetite be for, you know, obviously you could do Trevor Richards opener and then Bowden Francis, but to give Bowden Francis another shot at the rotation? I know he did not look very good in his first kind of audition those first two starts of the year, but he looked pretty good out of the bullpen. He's looked very good at AAA.
Yeah, I think that Bowden Francis's stuff is good for like 15 hitters tops, yeah. You know, like it's, that's kind of what the Blue Jays have discovered over the last couple of years is that like the stuff just does not maintain through two full trips through the lineup. It's, that could change, but that's what we've seen to this point. So I know the Blue Jays, like bringing Bowden Francis back from the IL, envisioned him in a multi-inning relief role. Like that's where they felt he was best suited for the rest of this year. And so I would imagine that's where he pitches. Like, I just don't think that you're going to get five innings from Bowden Francis, but if you can get two from Trevor Richards and like three and a third from Bowden Francis or three and two thirds, and then, you know, bring in your bullpen from there, that can be sustainable.
Yeah, and it you know, it does put a little bit of pressure on your other four starters to, you know, go a little bit longer because, yes, you get the, you technically have a ninth man in the bullpen, but two of those guys are basically, well, they're only going to pitch on the fifth day. Maybe you could use Richards in between. They kind of do whatever with him, as we've established. With respect to Yariel, he did throw 36 pitches. That was his second rehab outing. He's going to pitch again Friday. What do you think their appetite would be like, given that we're also working under an innings constraint for the entire year for Yariel Rodriguez? Is he a guy that would come back kind of as a 3-4 inning bulk guy rather than a full starter too, maybe?
And it's so hard to peg down where that like workload restriction would have been, you know, like coming into the year, like you kind of heard things like, yeah, around 100 innings. But like at this point with his, you know, the setback in spring and now this one as well, like, he's thrown a lot of pitches in non-game environments,
yeah.
Like a lot of bullpens and it's just kind of hard to keep track of where the Blue Jays would be at with his workload, that I don't know that like his innings pitched on his baseball reference page would necessarily reflect it.
Yeah.
And the club wants him to be available for the rest of the season. If you get to the trade deadline and you're selling and you're out of it, that changes everything. But for now, you do still have to maintain a posture as, we're trying to win. We're trying to get back into this thing. We're going to go on a streak right now, and we're going to need a guy like Yariel Rodriguez to throw high-intensity, high-leverage innings for us over the second half. So you do want to be mindful of that as well. Another guy who I don't expect the Blue Jays to be putting out there for five innings. Like another guy who I don't expect you to see like 100 pitches out of when he gets built back up. Like, you know, Rodriguez does fall into that like Francis like range as well of like 70-75 pitches, you know, three plus innings, not really a five inning guy.
Yeah, which again, you can have that if the guy's effective and you have a good bullpen or a long bullpen, the Jays with a couple of guys who can go multi innings, maybe you can cobble it together. But the other concern here is that the bullpen hasn't been very good. So then you're, you know, it's one thing when you're getting to a bullpen, you know, that's the 2015 Kansas City Royals or something like that, right? It's another thing if it's a bullpen that has length but hasn't been particularly effective. Let's quickly mention some of the other options. Paolo Espino is on the 40-man. He's been starting at AAA. He has a 4.81 ERA. That's trended at least in the right direction. He started finding the zone again. You imagine he's probably like, he's more in the kind of Brandon Little, Hagen Danner, Joey Cunnell class of like, if we need an extra arm at the back end of the bullpen,
we need somebody who can throw five.
Yeah,
that's Paolo Espino, right? Like, it's not going to be pretty. His stuff isn't you know, going to blow anybody away in the big leagues, but he can chew some innings for you, and he's pretty flexible as well in the, you know, how you use him. You know, like the you look at how the Nationals used him when he was with them, and it was just kind of, he was just like their rubbered armed, like anytime, anywhere kind of guy. But you would hope that, like, if you're trying to be really competitive and you're trying to win games against the Orioles and the Guardians and the Mariners, like, I don't have to tell you, like, the schedule is not easy in June.
Yeah,
you're going to want someone who probably gives you a better chance of doing that.
Yeah. Have been asked about Aaron Sanchez at times as well. First of all, he's only made three starts down there, but they have not gone well. That's about AAA depth, not about major league depth. We could go a little further down. The Jays have not been super aggressive promoting guys from lower levels of the minors in the past. Adam Mako has been really good, but he's also a guy that hasn't been on a 5-day rotation yet and is only now throwing, like, he's had a good season, but he's only now throwing like full pitching loads and things like that. 3.68 ERA, 31% strikeout rate, you know, really good underlying metrics. Is Mako someone you could see being on the radar if this comes up a little later in the season?
I'd be really surprised if the Blue Jays were that aggressive. Like last year, the Blue Jays were just trying to get Mako to a place where like he was healthy, right? And like consistent, because that has been a struggle for him throughout his career. They got him there late last year. They also saw a pretty encouraging little velo uptick late last year, which I think was big. So they're going to try to build on that this year. I don't think they would sacrifice that developmental strategy in that time in order to push him to the big leagues. Like, that would be a lot to ask of a guy who, like, has a promising future as, like, a Semro Bersa type, right? Like, big loop and curveball, not amazing velo. But, you know, if he's in the zone, which... again, has been an issue for him, like, as a guy who, like, the command...
got the walk rate down to single digits this year, at least. I know that we're not setting the bar super, super high here, but when you strike out 31% of the guys you're facing, 9% walk rate can be okay.
Yeah, no, the command hasn't always been there for him throughout his career, so now that they've kind of, like, made these strides of having him healthy, having a bit more velo, having him in the zone more often, like, they're going to want to keep, like, building on that. You don't want to be like, okay, to the majors you go from double A to face the Orioles. That would be asking a lot. I'd be really surprised if the Blue Jays did that.
Yeah, I would be asking a lot of CJ Van Eyck, Trenton Wallace, two other guys at double A who Van Eyck has a bad ERA, but he got really lit up in the first two starts of the season. He doesn't have a very good fastball, but it's been trending in the right direction, at least results wise. Trenton Wallace, another guy who throws kind of soft, but has a 239 ERA at double A. But both of those guys are, you know, let's get them to triple A and see how it looks.
I think you'd see Espino or waiver claim before you saw any of those guys starting for the Blue Jays in the next 2 months.
Okay. And yeah, waiver claim, they always exist. Mitch White's already on his third team of the year. Maybe he comes back around. When you look at this, how do you, like, a lot has happened in that fifth starter spot. The names we just went over, you know, Yariel Rodriguez is hurt, but you knew that he was probably going to have an innings cap for the year. Bowden Francis is hurt, but you probably knew coming into the year that ideally he was a multi-inning bullpen guy for you. Alek Manoah is now hurt. Ricky Tiedemann is hurt again through a bullpen yesterday, but he's not back in game action. Mitch White and Wes Parsons are gone, but those guys weren't effective enough to really stress out about it. What do you make of, you know, this is not the first year that we're talking about the lack of startable depth at the high levels of the minors.
It's funny because coming into the year, I was like, the Blue Jays have better starting pitching depth this year.
It was
year.
Better, but that's in retrospect, it was kind of a low bar.
I was saying it's better than it's been in several years. So they did a better job of building that out this year. It's just another example of how you never have enough. Like, there's no organization in baseball that is like, yep, we have like this just stockpile of amazing starters at AAA that we can call on at any point, right? Like, for the Blue Jays to have uncertainty in the number five spot in their rotation right now, 29 other teams are like, welcome to the club.
We don't know who the Pirates are starting this weekend.
Right? You know, a lot of teams have uncertainty in the number four spot in their rotation. And look, like, the Blue Jays have suffered some unfortunate injuries. You just went over them, but talk to the Tampa Bay Rays about pitching injuries. You know, talk to the Texas Rangers about pitching injuries. Like, it's like, pitchers get hurt, man. They break. It's remarkable what the Blue Jays have had in terms of quality and consistency from the top four in their rotation over the last 2 years. It's like, it will be such a waste if they don't go to the postseason this year. If this ends up being a lost season, the type of starting pitching they've gotten over the last 2 years, it's so rare in baseball. It's rare in franchise history. I don't think it's hyperbolic to say that, like, the last 2 years has been, in terms of, like, quality and depth, the best rotation the Blue Jays have ever had in franchise history. So, like, what they're going to go through right now with the number five spot and with some of the injuries they're dealing with, that's just what all teams deal with at this level. It's the reality of the game.
Yeah. If in retrospect you had the best rotation in franchise history over a 2-3 year window and you won zero playoff games, that would be
write a book about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd rather not. I would rather write a nice book if I'm going to go down that road. Two other notes on the bullpen here behind those stars. So Eric Swanson is now down in AAA. Tough decision, I'm sure. When we look at how we'll qualify what he's doing at AAA. Like, they had just given him five extremely low leverage outings at the major league level. He got through all of them, shut out. And then the second he was back in leverage, gave up a home run again. I'm not saying that's a mental thing about the leverage or whatever, but given that he did have five low leverage outings in a row where he was pretty good, what would constitute success? What would constitute readiness at AAA?
It's just location with him. It's just command, right? The stuff is consistent year over year. He's just been leaving his splitter in some really bad parts of the strike zone. And I know he feels like he had a little issue with tipping earlier this year, and you've seen the changes he's made to his delivery. I don't know how much of that's real, how much of that is...
Also, tipping's one thing, but, like, if it's right over the center of the plate, like, it doesn't really matter if it's a fastball or a splitter, right?
It is a bad combination if the hitter knows what's coming and it's also left in the happy zone. Like, that's as bad a combination as you can have at the big league level. So the way that, like, things like this work is the Blue Jays will have told Eric Swanson, look, you're going to be – here's your schedule, right? You're going to be pitching on Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday next week. Like, with a guy like him – it's not like Casey Candel is just going to be able to, like, summon him from the bullpen. He's going to be on a little bit of a schedule. Okay. And so they'll have, you know, pitches that they want him to get to and things they want him to work on, and he'll have a little bit of predictability there. So if he can just, like, get the command back and get the location better, it's not a stuff issue. It doesn't appear to be a health issue. So a little bit of time away from, like, the pressures of a big league environment to work on that. Could be a quick thing. It'll just depend on who else is in the Blue Jays bullpen, who else is performing. Like, ultimately, it's a meritocratic decision. Like, yeah, he had a 9 ERA, you know? Like, nobody has had worse results in the Blue Jays bullpen who's still in there today. So he'll have to pitch his way back for sure.
So this AAA team is suddenly very fascinating, right? Eric Swanson's down there. Yariel Rodriguez is going to start on Friday. Bowden Francis, I'd imagine, is rejoining the team this weekend, but he's down there for now. There are also some guys hitting pretty well. And I know the Jays' bats have been going a little bit better lately. I think that is a lot more to do with the best players hitting a lot better. The guys at kind of the fringes of the lineup or on the bench have not performed particularly well. Are you at a point where, you know, a Spencer Horwitz or someone like that is, like, you would like to see them get a try in one of those kind of reserve spots?
I mean, you could make the Horwitz for Vogelback swap pretty easily, but then you're just not going to see Spencer Horwitz play a whole lot. Mm-hmm. Like, that 26th spot, they just don't use it. We've seen this.
For years.
For years, yeah. We saw it with Jackie Bradley Jr. and Bradley Zimmer and Nathan Lucas, and now we're seeing it with Daniel Vogelback. Like, they just pick a very, like, specific skill that they want to carry in that spot, whether it's speed or elite defense, or in Vogelback's case prior to this year, you know, the ability to slug off of right-handed pitching and to come in and, you know, work a, you hope, pinch hit, walk, or home run. And I think the thing that they like about Vogelback is that he can sit around for a week and then come in to a pinch hit spot and still work a consistent approach. And for a younger player, somebody who's not used to that role, it might not be, you know, as seamless or as easy to take on that role. So if you're bringing Spencer Horwitz up, like, you want him playing. If you're bringing Aurelvis Martinez up, you want him playing. And right now, I just don't think those paths to playing time are super clear. It would require, like, quite a reduction in George Springer's playing time or Justin Turner's playing time. And you can make a case for Turner, certainly. For Springer right now, as he's kind of figuring it out, heating up a bit, taking a bunch of walks, turning on some fastballs, I think you want him to continue playing. With Turner, like, the results haven't been there all month. You can make more of a case there to reduce his playing time. But, like, the sneaky thing with Turner is if you're going to sell at the deadline, you want to give him some runway to get things turned around. Like, you want to give him opportunities to get his bat going because he's one of the players that you would be trading.
My argument would be you need to do, like, everything you can to make sure you're not selling at the deadline first. So I'm not going to make my lineup decisions based on that. But also, like, yeah, you're not going to shelve him permanently. And yeah, the playing time thing with Aurelvis, like, even then, even in his case, like, he's cooled off a little bit at AAA other than the power tool. Horwitz is 26, so I could stomach it a little bit more. Also guest on the show yesterday. So, you know, Vogelback hasn't come on. So we'll see how that shakes out there. We only have 2 minutes left here. We're missing Paul Skeens and Jared Jones this weekend.
I know. Bummer.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah. What are you looking for this weekend that tells you, you know, the Jays, like, obviously you sweep the series or whatever, but is there anything underlying? Is it just as simple as, like, yeah, if Vlad and Bo and Varshaw are still hitting, this team's going to be kind of okay against this level of competition?
You want to carry some momentum into the Orioles next week. That's the big one. You got 4 games against the Orioles next week. So, like, it's hard to sweep back-to-back series. I think, you know, 2-1 this weekend is a reasonable expectation. If you get all 3, like, great. Like, the big one is the Orioles next weekend. And then you got the A's after that, so another little soft spot. But then you got, like, killers.
Nothing but division leaders after that.
For the rest of the month, right? Yeah. So you want to carry forward some of this momentum. You want to see George Springer continuing to feel as comfortable at the plate as he is. You want to see, you know, Vladimir Arise continuing to do what he's been doing. You want Bo to continue to be, like, taking shots and taking chances, being aggressive. You want Davis Schneider to continue making the adjustments he's made and being patient and making more contact. Like, all these things that have kind of, you know, turned around lately against some softer competition, you want to see that continue and then sustain into the four games next week when we really kind of learn something about this team of, like, whether they have turned a corner or whether it was just the product of the competition they're playing.
Yeah, I certainly feel one way about the White Sox. The Pirates are at least like a reasonable Major League Baseball team, even if you are missing their best two starters. Arden Zwelling, thanks for taking the time out this morning, buddy.
No worries, man. Anytime.
Arden Zwelling of Sportsnet, of sportsnet.ca. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Peter Flaherty about the NCAA tournament and set up the MLB draft a little early here. We'll talk to Lance Brzdowski, pitching analyst at Marquee and on his own page, about some of what's going on with the Blue Jays pitchers right now, positive and concerning in the case of Jordan Romano. We'll also answer a bunch of your texts, so keep the texts coming to 590-590. We'll sprinkle those in the second hour as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network at Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, a little I Love College there as we talk about the NCAA tournament. We'll talk to Peter Flaherty of Baseball America in a little bit here. I'm going to answer some of your texts. First, you can text us to 590-590. We're also going to talk to Lance Brzdowski, who's one of my favorite pitching analysts to talk to in the second part of this show. We'll talk, Jordan Romano did give up another home run yesterday. ERA up to 6.59 now, and there's more going on here than just, hey, he doesn't pitch that well in tied game situations or, you know, three-run lead situations. The slider's been a little amiss. His mound placement has changed, so maybe he's trying to correct something there. It'll be interesting to track. So you can keep texting us to 590-590. We'll sprinkle them in throughout the second hour here. I'm also curious. I mean, there's no way to tell, but I am curious what the appetite is for NCAA baseball and draft stuff because, you know, it's not as big a part of the baseball culture as it is in some other sports, but it is fascinating. And, you know, this front office hasn't done the best job drafting and developing. You know, 2016 was a very successful draft for them with Bo Bichette and Kevin Biggio in the second and fifth round, respectively. Alek Manoah was obviously a good draft and develop find, but the Jays don't have a ton of homegrown on their roster, and specifically not a ton of homegrown through the draft. So I like putting a closer eye on it, try to figure it out, try to learn a bit about this, and we're going to see some NCAA tournament headlines over the next couple of weeks. And Major League Baseball draft, by the way, happens around All-Star break. There are a couple of interesting Canadians in the draft this year as well. Nobody near the tippy top, and like I said earlier, there is when we look at the Canadians in the 2024 draft, it skews pretty heavily toward prep prospects, so high school kids, there are a couple interesting NCAA names, so we'll get you set up for, if you're paying attention to that tournament, which teams are loaded with Canadians, including one, by the way, that has 14 Canadians. That's basically Team Canada NCAA. That is Niagara University. Let's talk to Peter Flaherty, national writer and analyst at Baseball America, covering the college covering college baseball and the MLB draft. Peter, what's going on, man? How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me on.
No problem, man. I guess high level, how excited are you? This has got to be like the absolute best time of year for you, right? This next 6 weeks or so?
Yeah, I'm at a 10 out of 10. I was saying on a podcast earlier that it feels a little bit like Christmas Eve, today being the day before the tournament, and then obviously the draft cycle heating up. So the most fun time of the year.
Yeah, definitely for you guys, certainly. I'm curious, at a, you know, prepping for the draft level, obviously you're covering the NCAA tournament. It's its own thing. It's a blast. It's good baseball. How much does the NCAA tournament and the way guys perform in this, you know, big pressure cooker environment and kind of as their last statement, the teams, like how much are your draft feelings and even your draft rankings still in flux here a little bit based on how the next couple of weeks go?
Yeah, that's a great point. It absolutely could help a lot of guys' stock. We've seen it in the past, especially with pitchers, namely Cade Horton with Oklahoma back in 2022. If they're at the forefront of a College World Series run for their respective team, that's that's really going to boost their stock and make them a lot of money. Like, there are a lot of pitchers this year in the late first round or comp round range or even early second round who are on really high level clubs. And if those teams make a run to Omaha or, you know, deep into a super regional, that could really boost their stock and cement them as a potential first rounder. So it is certainly still a little bit in flux.
So when it comes to the draft, there's obviously the tournament that you can make your kind of last case in. And Major League Baseball has also been trying to make the combine a bit of a thing. There'll be a draft combine between now and the draft. Obviously, some useful stuff the teams can take from there. Are you a fan of that move? Is that not, or, you know, baseball being a sport where we're going to learn a lot in games? Like, what is your appetite for the combine and that becoming a part of the how we get ready for the draft process?
I'm not really a fan of it. I know that there are a lot of people who aren't fans of it. Outside of interviews with teams and medical evaluations, I don't really see the point of it. I don't think that, especially from college players, you're not going to learn anything new from an extremely controlled environment where guys are going to take three rounds of batting practice and 8 to 12 ground balls or fly balls at their respective positions. I think from what they do actually on the field, it's pointless, but you know, you can get something out of it from conducting draft interviews and doing the medical stuff.
Okay, so it is tournament time. Let's take a little look at the tournament. I know over at Baseball America, you kind of broke down your top teams for this tournament. You ranked them all 1 through 64. Full disclosure, I did not read all 64. I'm not that locked in on college baseball. But you know, give us a kind of a look at the top of this. I know you had Tennessee at the very top, but it read like it's a pretty deep and competitive field through the top 5, 6, 8 even.
Yeah, like we've been saying all year over at baseballamerica.com and our pieces and podcasts, there isn't an LSU or a Wake Forest of 2023 where at this point last year it was long established where it was like, okay, you know, these are the two teams at the top and then it's everyone else. That's not the case this year, which I think makes this tournament a lot of fun. Like, yes, I have Tennessee as my top team in the field, and they're my pick to win the national championship. But in looking up and down this list and just looking through the tournament field, you could make an argument for a lot of these teams to make a run to a national championship, whether it be some of these higher-end teams, Kentucky, Texas A&M, North Carolina, or Arkansas, or even if you want to get into a little bit more of a sleeper pick with someone like Florida State, Oklahoma State. LSU has now been playing their best baseball at the best time after a little bit of a slower start. And, you know, out west, UC Santa Barbara, its pitching staff can go toe-to-toe with anyone in the country. So no matter where you look, especially in the top 25 plus or so of this ranking, or just in general at the tournament field, you can make an argument for a deep run for almost all of these teams. Like, I think there's a lot of parity in the field, and that's not due to lack of talent. I just think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it sounds like it'll be a blast, and a wide open tournament field is always good watching. It's one of those things where, like, and this is true in the basketball NCAA tournament too, you want upsets, you want fun Cinderella runs like that, but you also want the very best teams playing against the very best teams at the end. So when there are more teams that have a case for the best team, we're going to get a better tournament out of it. Also, look, there are a lot of big prospects in this tournament, and there are probably some baseball fans who, yeah, enjoy the college ball, but they want to see a Charlie Condon and things like that. I know you wrote top 25 MLB draft prospects to know in the NCAA tournament at Baseball America. Who's kind of top of mind for you? Like, who are you trying to, or who are you most excited to see? Who is someone who is newer coming into this NCAA tournament season? Like, who are their eyes going to be drawn to? Who are we looking at?
Yeah, so my personal 1-1 in this year's draft class is Oregon State second baseman Travis Bazzana. He's from Sydney, Australia. He's done nothing but hit at a really, really high level, no matter where he's been, whether it be at Oregon State. He won MVP of the Cape Cod Baseball League, which is the premier summer collegiate baseball league for all college players. He dominated there. It's a super explosive operation in the plate. He's got power. The approach is outstanding. The feel for the barrel is elite. I think he's just a very complete player, and he's also a natural born leader as well. So he's my favorite player in the class. And then also, as you mentioned, Charlie Condon. at this point might be one of the more notable names in college baseball. It's double plus raw power that he's got no issue getting to in game. For someone his size at 6'6 and 220 pounds, he's got a uniquely, I think, compact and rather explosive operation. You oftentimes see guys with longer limbs get a little bit out of sync, but he does a really nice job keeping it compact and explosive. The barrel really gets going through the zone, and the field of hit there is also impressive. And then for me, the number one pitcher in this year's class is Arkansas left-hander Hagen Smith. I think his ERA is 1.46 or 1.48 with a 9-1 record. The headliners of his arsenal is a thunderous 1-2 punch and his upper 90s fastball with life through the zone, and then his hellacious sweeping slider that's got a ton of lateral tilt with some depth and also a ton of sharpness to it. Those are two borderline double plus pitches that he supplements with a budding split changeup. So those are kind of the big three. And then a guy to watch as I'm trying to think of someone who might not be a super household name, but is trending that way. Kentucky outfielder Ryan Waldschmidt came into this season a little bit under the radar, but he's been outstanding this year for the Wildcats. They're the number two overall seed in the tournament field. Another guy where it's plus hit, plus power at the plate. He's a really, really good athlete. He defends well. Overall, he might end up in left field long-term defensively, but that's not too much of a war on the profile. The approach and pitch recognition skills are both advanced. You're kind of buying the offensive profile here. He's got a good, strong body at 6'2", 205. There's a lot to like with Waldschmidt. So that's a guy who, as the tournament goes on, and if Kentucky makes a deep run, you're going to hear his name brought up a lot, I think.
Yeah, and I saw you mentioned in your piece that that's a guy who could play his way into the first round in July's draft as well. I was listening to you, Carlos Galazo, and Jeff Ponce on a podcast recently, and you guys were talking about how wide open the draft is beyond, maybe number 11. So Jay's picked 20th. I'm not asking you for a mock at who's going 20, but these are the headline names. Other than the last one there, these are the headline names. What are we looking for, or how does this draft class in general shape up around number 20? If you're a team like the Blue Jays who's going to pick later in that first round, what are we looking at in that meteor part of the first this year?
Yeah, so I'd say, like you said, there are, at this point, I think there's a group of eight or nine guys that I think people view as almost the consensus top players in the class, but there have been some other names recently that have crept their way into that conversation, namely James Tibbs, outfielder at Florida State. And what's going to make this draft so much fun is the number of different directions it could go in, really past pick, I don't know, 7 or 8, definitely outside of 10, it could go haywire, but someone's going to be there at 20 that I think Jays fans are going to be really happy about, whether it's outfielder Carson Benj at Oklahoma State, who is one of my personal favorites in the draft class. The tool set in general and the upside is really, really exciting. Christian Moore, Tennessee second baseman, has been unbelievable for the Vols. It's really impressive bat speed at the plate. It's a super strong physical build plus power. I know that he's played his way probably squarely into the first round. How high he goes is TBD, but I know that that's someone who will be around at 20. Sam Houston State catcher Walker Yannick, there's an argument to be made that he's perhaps the top catcher in this draft class. That's maybe a little bit of an aggressive take, given that Caleb Lomavita from Cal is also in that conversation and he might get that nod. But from a defensive standpoint, Yannick is a plus defender. He's got really polished receiving skills. He's got a comfortably plus arm. He moves well for his size back there behind the plate, and offensively there's a lot to like as well. He's got a lengthy track record with the bat, both at Sam Houston and then also Wood Bat Performance, where he showed off the ability to generate high-end quality contact. So those are a couple of guys that could be there. Iowa right-hander Brody Brecht, I don't know if he's going to quite fall down to 20, but from a pure stuff standpoint, he's got the most high-end stuff in the draft of any pitcher, and he's an elite athlete at 6'4", 225. He's a former receiver on the Iowa football team. I could keep going on and on about names who could be there for the Jays, but someone at 20 will be there that I think Jays fans will be really happy about.
That's exciting. Yeah, and Brody Brecht, I think Kylie McDaniel of ESPN mentioned the Jays have been in on him. Just a question of if he's there still at 20. All right, Peter, this is a Canadian show. You're talking to Canada right now. Let's do a little CanCon. I know when it comes to this draft, the Canadian talent skews heavily toward high school kids rather than NCAA. But we do have a couple of interesting names. At Kentucky, Emilian Petrie, ranked number 185 by Major League Baseball. So, you know, not high on the radar, but we're talking he could be in the mix, you know, fourth, fifth round if things go well here. And I know that's a very good Kentucky team. What is your read on Petrie and his, you know, his long-term potential here?
Yeah, I like Petrie a lot. You know, I think that he fits best, like you said, in that sixth to eighth or so round range. But I think whoever ends up snagging him somewhere in there, they're going to be really happy about it. It's a polished bat. I think that the hit tool is really, really advanced. He's got an excellent feel for the barrel. The approach and pitch recognition skills are also both present and advanced, and he's flashed it at the highest levels of college baseball. And he can also pick it over at second base. Like, I think he is a very sneaky and interesting draft prospect that I know that teams are really excited about. So I think that he could end up a lot closer to maybe the fifth or the sixth round than the eighth or the ninth. But there are some tools to be, I'd say, excited about with Petrie.
Okay, so at the team level, Niagara University has 14 Canadians. I know you had them down at 60 in your ranking of the field of 64, but what could happen there for us? Well, what's, you know, that's obviously the upset team I'm going to hitch my wagon to since they have 14 Canadians. What would have to go right for Niagara to turn this, to keep going? I think this is their first time even in the tournament. So obviously already a huge success, but to keep it rolling from here.
Yeah, well, someone had to be down there at 60, but I'm with you that they're a really intriguing team that, people have a chance to fall in love with here as regionals keep going on. And as you mentioned, they had a wildly successful season, 38-15, 20-4 in the MAC in their conference. It's their first ever tournament appearance. And then also their 38 overall wins and 20 conference wins are both new single season records. And being sent to Stillwater, Oklahoma, where Oklahoma State's hosting, for those who don't know, Obrate Stadium is an extremely hitter-friendly environment, which I think bodes really well for the Purple Eagles. They can swing it. They swing the bats really, really well. And they've got a deep lineup. I'm curious to see what maybe the lack of pitching depth on the mound that might do them in the end, but they're going to be far from a pushover, I think, for Oklahoma State. And it's going to be a really interesting game. And my favorite prospect on that roster is a Canadian kid, outfielder Nick Groves.
Scrappy
runner. Oh yeah. He can really, really run. Advanced feel for the barrel. He's just a really fun player who's a bit of a chaos causer on the base paths and just in general.
All right, last one for you before we let you go, Peter. Nebraska, you had them ranked 27th. They have a couple Canadians as well, including from St. Benedict's High School in Cambridge, Ontario, which is where I grew up, Riley Silva. I know he's not super high on the radar necessarily just yet, but that's a guy who can steal a base. Nebraska has 6 Canadians overall. What are we looking at from that team?
Yeah, they're again, it's the Stillwater Regional, I guess, is kind of the Canadian regional because they're also that they're in there and so is Niagara. But they had a really strong they took a major step forward this year in 2024. They won the Big Ten tournament for the first time since 2005, and they won their second most games in a single season since 2007. Their team ERA of 4.4 is the lowest in the Big Ten. And staff ace Brett Sears, his ERA of 2 exactly, it ranks 4th among all Division I pitchers. Like, I think that they absolutely have the upside to win the regional. It wouldn't totally floor me if they come out on top. And from a position player standpoint, one guy to watch is catcher Josh Caron. He had 321 he's hitting 321 this year with 15 doubles, 15 home runs, 64 RBIs. He's intriguing not only from a performance perspective. I think his 6 home runs were the most in a single Big Ten conference tournament in the history of the tournament. But from a draft perspective as well, he has top five or so round upside. The offensive profile is really impressive.
Well, that's a lot of it's going to be a lot of fun to track Nebraska and Niagara, the two most Canadian heavy teams. Yeah, and Stillwater Regional. I've always said the Stillwater Regional is the best, most competitive, most competitive regional. So that should be a lot of fun, Peter. Man, I hope you have a blast these next couple weeks with the tournament heading into draft season. Appreciate all the good work and appreciate your time today.
Thank you guys so much for having me on.
Peter Flaherty of Baseball America. And yeah, those two teams again are Niagara and Nebraska. Those are the teams you want to keep an eye on for, you know, for the CanCon there, as well as Emilian Petre from Kentucky, rather. Yeah, and shout out to Riley Silver, man. A notable NCAA tournament name from St. Benedict's in Cambridge popped me a little bit as I was doing my research for this one. You can keep texting us in, by the way, 590, 590. We'll sprinkle some in through the last part of the show here. I'm going to tee up our next guest with this question from Tyler and Barry. Romano doesn't look good. He topped out at 96 last night and doesn't look right at all. He needs that fastball 98, 99 to be effective. Jays aren't looking good with the pitchers. It's been a tough go in the bullpen. And yeah, the velocity is down on the fastball a little bit. There's some stuff with where Romano has placed himself on the mound and the shape of his slider has changed. So we're going to talk to Lance Brzdowski about Jordan Romano and what's going on there. So good question, Tyler. Obviously an ERA up around 6.5, even though he's only technically blown one save this year. You want to keep a little bit of an eye on that. Dylan in Toronto says, feel awful for Alec. The Yariel-Bowden tandem is probably the way to go here, assuming healthy returns. Yeah, and you're going to have, other names. Like Trevor Richards is going to be a name within that as well. Yariel's probably at least one more rehab start and probably even more than that away from being back. So we'll see. But yeah, Bowden Francis is going to factor in here. I'd be surprised if he's not activated on the weekend unless they do some sort of activate someone for Alec Manoah for the weekend series as an extra bullpen arm, and then that person goes down and Bowden Francis is activated for whenever they use that fifth starter spot, probably Tuesday against the Orioles. But there's also a possibility they juggle that, so their bullpen day is against lesser opponents. No breaks ahead, though. 36 games in 38 days, so good luck with that, guys. Pat and Peter Rose says, bring up Aaron Sanchez for the vibes. Yeah, I mean, it's not the worst idea in the world. He does have a 1350 ERA at AAA right now, and last we saw him in the majors, he was not particularly effective, but there's always a vibes component to be acknowledged here. Andy and Markham asks, chances we get a Blue Jay in the All-Star game? I will say 100% absolute guaranteed, because every baseball team gets at least, every team in the majors gets at least one player in the All-Star game. So yes, even the White Sox will somehow have an All-Star. Garrett Crochet, looking at you, buddy. Devin from Aurora says, why do you think the Jays are so sad on having clubhouse guys that don't produce versus guys that have a higher upside? I feel like the org is stuck in this path and won't change. It's interesting. My guess, Devin, would be it's not necessarily that they prefer good clubhouse guys at the expense of a skill or a utility or whatever, but that they don't see that the 26th roster spot is going to be used very much no matter what. So given that the spot is not going to be very heavily leaned on, they then err on the side of having a good clubhouse guy like a Vogelbach. Not that Nathan Lucas and Bradley Zimmer and those guys were like big raw guys in years past, but well-liked guys, guys you don't have to worry about, basically. So I think, punting on the 26th roster spot for a couple years in a row has not been the best way to manage the roster entirely versus, again, yeah, having a guy with a little bit more utility, even if it's situational utility, pinch running, that kind of thing. But yeah, all else equal, they'll lean with a good clubhouse guy. Brad in Sudbury says, what do I think of the leaked City Connect jerseys? Kind of meh. I don't care that much. It's also one of those things where I want to see how it looks on a player before I get too bothered by it necessarily. Like I said the other day on the show, mostly joking around with Lindsay, the bad version that leaked was not the exact version. You see the coloring looks a little bit better in the newer leaked one. There is a jersey number on the front part of the jersey that fills in the lower half of the jersey a little bit better, so you don't get that awkward kind of fumbly bottom of the skyline there. So they do look sharper than the initial leak. We'll see how it looks on a player. We'll find out tonight when they release them. I'm not sure what time of day they're putting them out on social. You can send us some more text to 590, 590. See if we fit them in today, maybe even tomorrow. We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, We'll talk to Lance Brozdowski, a pitching player development analyst at Marquee and pitching analyst on his own Substack and YouTube channel. Just one of the sharpest guys out there when it comes to evaluating what pitchers are trying to do, talking to them about what they're trying to do, and helping us become smarter when we're watching pitchers. We'll see what he thinks about a couple of these Blue Jays, positive and negative. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays win last night. They sweep the White Sox. Their first sweep of the season, but Alek Manoah leaves in the second inning feeling a pinchy feeling in his elbow. Side note to this game, we've been tracking this on the show and on Blue Jays Central. The Blue Jays broke the franchise record for most consecutive first innings without a run. They have now gone 21 games without scoring in the first inning. That is a franchise record. That is one off Oakland's season high in Major League Baseball this year. Only five times in the history of baseball, dating back to 1901 when we have inning by inning data, only five times has a team gone 27 games. So that's kind of the high water mark for, wow, you're into historical territory here. So not quite there yet, but it is a franchise record. 21 games. We'll see if they can get it going against the Pirates, who have not released their probable pitchers for the weekend yet, but we know we won't see Jared Jones or Paul Skeens. They both pitched yesterday in a doubleheader. So that part is disappointing, but let's talk pitching nonetheless. Nobody with quite the stuff of Jared Jones or Paul Skeens on this Toronto Blue Jays team, but still some interesting guys, and there's nobody better to help us break it down than Lance Brozdowski, a player development analyst at Marquee, terrific pitching analyst at his Lance Broz Substack and on his YouTube. Lance, what's going on? You got a fresh cut for the show too? What's up, man? How are you?
I'm trying to keep the hair a little more tame this year, so yeah, it's a little cleaner now. It's not as long. You should see me some old pics, man. I had like crazy long hair.
Well, I mean, you do the YouTube videos. We see some of it. Let's start with another guy with long hair. I know you talked to him recently. Ben Brown throws 7 no-hit innings yesterday. Pretty fun. Yesterday? Day before? Either way. Pretty fun stuff. How cool was that?
It's awesome. Yeah, he's been a guy I've been on for a bit. I've always really liked that curveball, which I now see kicking around everywhere. Everyone really enjoys that pitch. It's just really hard. It's a weird look. Super hot slot. Just kind of dives, and I just think it's a unique pitch, and I think in this era of baseball, we're all about these unique pitches, and he's got one.
Yeah, okay. So let's talk a couple Blue Jays. I do want to whip around some Major League stuff with you outside of the Jays if we have time at the end, but keep the focus on the Jays. You haven't done a lot of Jays in your, you know, so for anyone who doesn't remember or doesn't know, you do these daily pitching notes on your Substack. They're super valuable. They're a lot of fun for like, hey, pitchers throwing this differently or added this new pitch, changed their mound slot, things like that. So let's do a couple Blue Jays here. We had originally discussed going deep on Alek Manoah. Now, he left yesterday's game with an elbow issue, getting an MRI today. Let's assume that that's going to be okay-ish, and we're going to be talking about Alek Manoah again sometime soon. What had you seen from Alek Manoah since he kind of got back to the majors, 4.5 starts, I guess we'll call it, here so far this season?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a roller coaster for him, which it makes it often sometimes a bit hard to analyze because you're trying to dig into individual outings and see how much to project that forward specifically. So for me, the main thing that jumps out is the feel is up slightly and a little bit of shape improvement here and there on the four seam specifically. But I think for him, that shape improvement matters, even if it's really subtle, just from a playability standpoint in the zone. The thing that I think he's run into, though, if you look at any of these heat maps in terms of how he approaches pitchers, he's a very like centralized targets guy. So everything's just middle of the plate. The problem with that is that, especially versus lefties this year, he's run into some situations with the changeup in particular when that pitch is up or middle with the idea of trying to get it down, it's just getting clobbered. And same thing he's run into with the slider, give or take, in some situations. So it's tough because the peripheral suggests there's going to be some regression coming for him. You know, he had the back-to-back really strong starts where he went 7 each. So you could kind of pick and choose. I don't know if it's a matchup thing or it's just one of those random odd baseball situations where the pitches that are middle just don't get hit and then it looks good. I like that he's an aggressive pitcher overall. He's going to stay in zone. The walk rate will probably always be relatively tame because of that. But, you know, going forward, I think he's got to figure out the changeup a bit to lefties in particular to try to mitigate some of the damage to that handedness. you know, he's an interesting pitcher. He's been through so much. I feel like last year, I think we were on and chat about him, and it was just, it was like, I don't know, like the slider shape's weird. And, you know, he's hurt, he's down, you know, he got going late, et cetera. And I think that stuff oftentimes sometimes spills over. But yeah, I mean, I think he's an interesting arm. I wonder whether there's maybe another ticket command in there that could help him place the ball a little more than just ripping stuff middle. That I think could take him to more consistently what we saw in like 22 from him. For now, I mean, if we're assuming that he's okay and stuff, then I think he's kind of like a league average starter with upside for better, but also downside for worse, because we've seen that historically. So he's a higher variance guy to me. It's hard for me to like be super optimistic about him, but it's good that he's not almost unplayable like he was last year.
Yeah, I mean, they take league average starter at this point. And yeah, the change up to lefties, been hit hard. It's also like a weird movement profile where he throws it high in the zone. It's got like a lot of vertical to it in like the opposite direction. It's not one of the divey changeups. It's more like a Marco Estrada changeup, but obviously no one threw that high rising changeup like Marco Estrada. The other thing I wonder, and I'm putting you on the spot a little bit for this, but Chris Black, a producer at Sports that has suggested this to me before. Manoah's 6'6". He gets good extension down the mound, and he throws his two-seamer really well, big hands as well. Is that a guy to you who it might make sense to toy with a splitter in the offseason? Like, would that fit his arsenal and pitcher type?
Yeah, I mean, I love splitters, so I'm pro-splitter on the majority of guys. I think that it's just a pitch that needs to be thrown more. I mean, it's the year of the splitter, even though the usage is only up marginally over
3%.
Here and stuff. 3% from, what was it, like 1.5% a couple years ago? That's a huge difference. Like, doubling any percentage of a given pitch, regardless of how often it's used, is a huge thing from a macro standpoint, looking at the league pitch type usage. But I'm pro splitter. Like, if the guy can't kill vertical and you don't think the changeup is working because it's not killing vertical, then why not go towards it to some extent? It's just an easier way for guys to create drop on a pitch. It's just splitting your fingers up or jamming it. Or you see a lot of guys go to like different kind of Fosh grips, like between middle and ring. Jeremiah Estrada for the Padres is throwing like a really weird variation of that right now, and it's dominating. You know, there's a lot of variations of it. You've seen a lot of splinkers too, which are fun. That's like probably for guys with more velo. I don't think you'd give that to Manoah, but those high velo guys, kind of three-quarter slot, you know, you're not jamming the ball between your fingers like a split. What instead you're doing is basically going between like a standard sinker grip with similar fingers, and you're going like here and finding an orientation that works, trying to get the ball to sometimes rip off the middle finger and just set the axis and drop. But a lot of those guys, because they're not splitting their fingers, can throw it really hard. Mm. That's what makes them so effective. That's why you got like a Mason Miller, John Duran, Jose Soriano, and I imagine we're going to have more pop up. Skeens is the one I'm missing too. But so yeah, I'm pro splitter with Manoah. I went a bit a roundabout way there, but yeah.
Yeah, it's, you mentioned Jeremiah Estrada too, and I know it's not a similar pitcher type to Manoah generally, but any pitch that's getting a 58% swing and miss rate and gets you 13 consecutive strikeouts, I'm going to take a look at what's going on there. Another guy who added a splitter this offseason, we don't have a ton of sample on it, obviously, because you know, he only pitched a little bit and then hit the IL, but we're going to see him more. I'd imagine he's part of the solution for while Alek Manoah is on the IL, if Manoah is headed to the IL. That's Bowden Francis. He started twice. He got rocked. They moved him back into that kind of multi-inning relief role that he thrived in last year. What do you like about Bowden Francis? Is there enough there for a like two-time through the order guy? Is he probably destined for, hey, he could be a bulk guy in a bullpen, and that's valuable, but the starting stuff is we've moved past it.
No, I think I like him as a starter. I'm very pro be aggressive with any young guy who you think can be some kind of starter. Like, I just generally don't like when they flip these guys to relievers, even if they end up being good, because the value is just never high enough. But with Francis in particular, I like it. I like the four-seam shape. I know, you know, Saris' stuff model likes the four-seam shape. It's a pretty good pitch, you know, 94, good amount of carry, average release. The thing that's interesting to me, and I think my main hesitation is that pitch you see right there, the curveball. That pitch is interesting. I generally think I'm anti- throw a lot of curveballs, even if it's a good curveball, unless it's like super, super hard. His is like mid 70s. I don't love when guys throw like 30% curveball to either handedness and it's not 80 plus. I just generally fade that profile overall. Now, it's worked for him. Like, that pitch has been good. It's limited contact quality. I would argue to some extent that mix is part of the reason why the four seam's gotten beat up a bit. What you run into a lot of time with those loopy curveballs is that you call like release angle. The ball pops out of hand, right? This is why like curveballs generally are hard to make really good. Like, if you look at pitch quality leaderboards, it's rarely represented in terms of how much it's used. It's oftentimes an opposite handedness pitch creates some drop, change of look, change speed. It's rarely a pitch you could throw 35%, 30% to either hand and this and work. So I think to some extent there might be some idea there that against a guy like Francis, if it's not popping, right, it's a fastball, and then it's just going to get crushed. You guys are going to swing at it. And it's a good fastball, but it's not going to dominate guys like a Jared Jones or a Spencer Strider fastball. So I'd love to see either a development of the slider, throw that harder. You know, I think it's like 84-ish right now. See if you can get that up to 85, 86. That might be hard to do. He's only throwing 94. But the thing we did see, you mentioned adding the splitter. If you look at his AAA usage in this most recent kind of rehab stint for him, his splitter usage to lefties is up a lot. It was like 15% used when he was in the majors to start the season when he was, you know, again, he got kind of beat up. He goes down. Now that pitch is almost used, like, I think 25 to 30% versus lefties. Love that. Again, we're talking splitters. Good way to kill vertical. Generally, overall, like, they're really good at limiting barrels and generating swing and miss. So I really like that tweak. I hope that sticks. I hope that becomes his primary pitch to left-handed hitters. And then it's going to be a matter, again, to me, of, like, figuring out something else from the breaking ball perspective to righties, which, again, I get it's been good. I just am always hesitant on guys throwing, like, 35% curveball. You know, like, the sample's so small. It's like Lance McCullers, who threw his, like, 84. Ben Brown technically throws a curve. It's barely a curve. Adam Wainwright is probably, like, the only guy, and, like, that's more outlier. Like, I wouldn't try to make your pitcher Adam Wainwright. I would try to figure out another breaker there that's harder. That, you know, he's zoning that curveball pretty well, but give me a harder breaker, less movement, spot it, use it versus righties, and not a ton of 75. So, again, I'm playing a little like amateur pitch design here, but give me a ton of splitter lefties and figure out another breaker for righties, and I think you got something here. Don't scrap the curveball, but I like 30% usage on that. It's just aggressive for me.
Yeah, like you said, the list of guys who throw it that much and throw it that much effectively is, I think Ben Brown's the only guy in the top 75 who, like, in terms of run value, that has a curveball in that top 75.
And it's barely a curve.
Yeah.
It's a slider. It's a depthy slider.
And then, like, Aaron Nola's is up there too, but, like, his is like the weird knuckle curve. Yeah, it's tough to live that way. I like the splitter. I talked about it a little bit about it earlier in the year and, like, how many different grips he had to go through to figure it out. Mm. And, like, you obviously have some guys around the Blue Jays to pick their brain on. Kevin Gausman throws one. Swanson throws one. Bassett doesn't really, but Bassett's like the king of having infinity different pitches and knowing how to work it and stuff. So it's been cool to see the splitter slowly develop here. Excited to see it if we get more back. Another guy I wanted to ask you about on the Blue Jays, Jordan Romano gives up a home run last night. His ERA is up over 650 now. He's such an interesting guy because he's a two-pitch guy, right? Like, he's fastball slider. You pointed out something pretty early this year. He made a really significant move in terms of where he's throwing on the mound, and that has stayed. He's stuck with that. He's kind of all over the place as we dig in. And some of that is just, you know, he's thrown, what, 13 innings because he's a relief pitcher and we're at the end of May. But what have you made of Jordan Romano's struggles? I know you looked into him a little bit for us today.
Yeah, the four-seam whiff has completely disappeared here. It's a little bit shocking when I looked at it. It was like a pitch consistently missed bats about 30% of the time last year. Just basically, how often do you swing and miss at the pitch? The average for four-seam fastball is like 22%. Most relievers are probably popping 25% plus. Romano's was good. This year, it's like below 7% to either handedness. It's not just like, oh, it's a lefty problem, or oh, it's a righty problem. The pitch is just not missing bats. And it's odd because the only thing that jumps out to me is that his arm angle's up slightly, so his release height's a little higher. And he's keeping the same shape on the four seam. Now, that could affect the visual for the hitter in terms of the angle that ball's approaching the zone. Like, if you think about, like, everything maintaining the same, but your arm's a little higher, that pitch in terms of the angle it's entering the zone at isn't going to be perhaps as flat. Now, if that is driving this big of a drop, that would be a little bit odd to me, right? Like, it's one of those things, like, a lot of the situations, I love using the metaphor like a pie, right? Something happens, you need to figure out why you have a pie, like a blame pie, so to speak. And there's a lot of components of that blame pie. I think one of them could be the fact that his arm's a little higher. The other one here that jumps out is just he had elbow inflammation in spring, right? You got a little delayed start. So, like, your timeline's messed up. You know, is that still bothering him? I generally don't like speculating on injuries, but when you see a guy struggling, there isn't really a dramatic change in any shape or anything. You know, I oftentimes just go, okay, when was the last time he was injured? With Romano, you could go back and see, like, oh, he had elbow inflammation a bit ago, and now he's pitching. So I hate speculating on this stuff, but, like, if in a month he's IL'd again and they shut him down, it's going to be one of those things where you're like, oh, okay, well, that's why. You don't really need to like overanalyze the underlying stats as to why he was struggling. He's just probably pitching somewhat hurt. And we've even heard like a guy like Blake Snell mention this, where he's come back and he's kind of struggled to start the year. And he mentioned like it's really hard in spring to not have a spring where you're facing like major league hitters, you know, and now he's facing major league hitters. And they're very different than AAA hitters overall. I think that gap is massively widening between AAA and the majors, where guys are coming up and really struggling. So you just run into these situations where it's like, he's again 13 innings. You know, I don't know prior to pitching in the bigs this year where he had much rehab or ability to throw against live batters that were really good. So you just run into a lot of issues here, I think, where it's just, I can't really describe it. If you want like a short fix from my angle, it would just be to throw more slider. That pitch seems to be, you know, same velo, same shape for the most part. You know, it's not in zone as much as the four seam. So maybe you sacrifice some walks, but you're going to pick up swing and miss. I might back off the four seam usage right now, because my God, that's got to be one of the more dramatic like swing miss falls in the league right now. It's I don't want to say it's not a throwable pitch, but you don't have anything else. He's a two-pitch guy, so you have to throw it. It's just, I guess, bring the usage down to like 30-35% and just really hope that he can rip 60% slider and figures this out over time with the four seam.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Anytime it's a two-pitch guy, right, it's a tough solution. And we'll get texts sometimes in the text line about, you know, hey, he should throw the fastball more. Why does he throw the slider so much? The fastball is like 96, 97. It's a good fastball. But yeah, the results just haven't been there this year. Like it's getting hit hard and it's getting hit pretty often. So it'll be interesting to track how he, you know, and look, there's a track record there. So he'll probably figure it out. Hopefully figure it out. Also moved into third. All I should know, he moved into third all time in Blue Jay saves last night. Only Tom Hanke and Dwayne Ward ahead of him now. Okay, Yusei Kikuchi.
Can I ask you something on Romano quick? So a lot of speculation on him being traded. Do you think he gets shipped?
I think that has a lot more to do with the rest of the team from here. Like the Jays right now, the party line is they're a couple games out and a couple games under 500, but like they're going to give it a chance to get back to, you know, I don't know. Like get to 500 after this Pirates series, you know, enter July, a handful of games above 500, and they would be in like light buyer's mode at that point. But yeah, if there are a couple games under 500 at the start of July, like he'd be available, I think, in the right deal. Jimmy Garcia would be available. You know, maybe even Yusei Kikuchi, who I'm going to ask you about next. Like in terms of like rental starting pitchers who could be available if things go poorly for the Blue Jays, like he's got to be at the very, very top of the list with the way he's pitched this year. What have you liked about Kikuchi's season?
Yeah, he's had an interesting run. I mean, the big thing here is like the homer rate just completely cut in half. Like each of the last three seasons, he's had a pretty big homer problem. And from the data perspective, a lot of the time, homers are tough to predict. They're pretty noisy. But you do run into situations where like guys have homer problems for multiple seasons. And at that point, you're like, he's doing something that is causing him to give up homers. You know, like even if year over year, it's not totally predictable or there's a lot of variance and noise in it, especially based on park, et cetera. If a guy's done it for 3 years, I think I'd confidently project like a worse than league average homer rate. Instead, what we get from Kikuchi this year is that's completely gone. And that is, I think, driving a lot of the underlying peripheral success that says he's like now more of like a 3 ERA pitcher, which is really good, you know, compared to what he's had in the past. He's had some roller coaster seasons or roller coaster careers, so to speak, good years, bad years, mixed from my perspective, at least nationally and stuff. The key thing for me that I found interesting is the four seam to righties in particular. A lot of time with lefties, I just don't really look at same handed stuff. So I'll look specifically at righties in terms of what he's doing differently. Throwing a lot of curveball looks pretty good. All the breakers there and all the off speed look pretty good versus righties. The fastball, the underlying stuff isn't totally amazing, so to speak. You know, last year he was throwing that pitch up a little more. He had some trouble with it. It seems to me very subtly like they've tried to throw that more kind of middle away as opposed to elevating as much. And it hasn't been as great from an underlying stat standpoint, but I wonder whether that like subtle change in location on the four seam has helped everything else in the mix. If you think of just like, I think of it this way, like if you're throwing a fastball up and a slider away as a, let's go righty versus righty, fastball up, slider away, those pitches separate pretty quickly. So if you're a hitter trying to prep for that, you're like, okay, if it's up or inside to some extent, it's probably some kind of four seam, but if it's away, it's some kind of slider, which you see like teams like the Dodgers do sometimes, is take good four seams and throw them like away. So you basically are splitting that location. So it's like, I'm going to try to disguise things on the outer third of the plate by throwing something really hard. I call this like pitching in line, so to speak. So with Kikuchi bringing the four seam down in the zone a little more, I wonder whether that's kind of disguising the curve, the slider, the change, everything else in his mix to righties, where it's like hitters are like, if I guess four seam and I'm right on four seam, that pitch ends up middle, away-ish middle, I'm going to hit it, which has happened to some extent. Or even if it's up, I'm going to hit it. But everything else now is a little more complex for me to key in on and hit. So it's that you see everything secondary-wise in his mix working really well. The four-seam fastball underlying stuff, again, is not amazing. Now, the odd thing here is when you don't have two pitches you can strike at an above-average rate or zone at an above-average rate, you become, I don't want to say like a fastball-dependent guy, but your floor on your fastball usage can't go much lower. So he's throwing that like 45, 50% of the time. In theory, you see the results on all the secondaries, and you go, just throw those more, like stop throwing the fastball 45% of the time. But if you do that, then the walk rate's going to come back up. So you run into this odd situation where, you know, maybe throw more change up, but that's out of zone a lot. So I think I would, if again, amateur pitch design here, I think I would try to encourage a little less fastball usage, but maybe do it more sporadically in ways that like a hitter wouldn't expect. Not just like, you know, in the count, let's throw a bunch more off speed. Like I would try to throw a little more off speed stuff early count where he's throwing the fastball more. I would try to lean, like, get off that pitch 50% of the time, bring that down to, like, 40% early count. Even if you run into a little more issues with count leverage, I still think, like, the secondaries are good enough for it to work for him. So I'm really impressed with that homer cut. Like, I like him going forward. He'd be a really interesting piece if Blue Jays end up sellers, like, what someone would pay for him. Because the track record of success isn't super long, but he's clearly done some things and made some adjustments this year that have helped him.
Man, you want the fastball usage down even lower. You do a video on all this decrease in fastball usage league-wide, and then we find out you're the cause. You're the one. No.
I know, right?
Less fastball for Jordan Romano, more slider. Less fastball for Kikuchi, more breaking stuff. It's you. You're driving the fastball decline.
It's me. It's me. I'm the problem. It's me. Is that a T-Swift line?
Yeah, absolutely. Lance, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Keep up all the great work. Always love having you on.
Thanks, Blake. Take care.
Lance Brzdowski, player development analyst at Marquee, pitching analyst at Lance Broz. So Lance, B-R-O-Z, that's his Twitter, that's his Substack, that's his YouTube. A lot of really great stuff league-wide, a lot of good breakdowns on his YouTube. And he talks to pitchers a lot. So, like, you know, they'll kind of let him in on what they're tinkering with and why and show him a lot of their grips and stuff like that, you know, Sara style. So really cool. I love talking to the guys about that kind of stuff. But, the pitchers, I mean, yeah, I'm fascinated to see what Bowden Francis looks like when he comes back as well. Because, yeah, maybe a little bit more splitter usage. I did talk to him about that a little bit early in the season. And, yeah, there's just it's funny. The splitter is like for anyone who – I mean, I think you can picture it. You put a baseball in your hand and try to do a split finger grip, like the Kevin Gausman grip. You really got to have huge hands to do that. I am 5'10", so I don't have – massive hands. I don't think the short, you know, Sonny Gray is not throwing a Kevin Gausman style splitter there. But it's always fun to get a window into what those guys are doing, how they design these pitches and tinker over the course of the year and things like that. Couple texts left to round us out here. No game tonight, so no matchups to set you up for. Someone who didn't sign there has asked the other day, would it be unreasonable to put Vlad in the leadoff spot in a vacuum where other guys on the team are hitting really well? No, it's not completely unrealistic. Vlad is your best on-base percentage guy. I'm a believer in a good OBP at the top of the lineup. And obviously, Vlad has not hit for a ton of power this year. So you look, hey, a guy who's hitting 294 with a 389 on base and doesn't hit for a ton of power, that to me screams leadoff hitter. But I think the problem there would be it's Vlad, and you want that power to come. You hope that power comes. I'm not saying that it wouldn't come in the leadoff spot, just they probably wouldn't make the move because they want Vlad to be a 2-3 hitter for them. They want him in that kind of meatiest part of the zone. Malcolm in Calgary asks, what's my favorite pitch to analyze? That's maybe a better question for Lance. I love the changeup. I think this is part of like some of my core Blue Jays fandom stuff is around Marco Estrada and those big outings in 2015 and 2016. Also the fact that, you know, he was a guy who we didn't have as many ways to measure why and how he was so successful with the changeup. So the guys who can be effective with it, I find really fascinating. There are also like a couple different kinds of changeup, like a couple different ways you can approach it from a movement and location standpoint. So, you know, I broke down Reese Olson's changeup on Blue Jays Central on the weekend. He's a fascinating guy that like The changeup is his best pitch, and he generates a ton of ground balls with it, and he never throws it in the zone. And nobody can lay off of it, though, because similar to what Lance was talking about with how you locate and how your pitches work together, he throws everything low in the zone. Like no pitcher in baseball throws their pitches on average lower in the zone. So if you're going against results and you're like, don't swing at anything low, it's going to be a changeup. It's going to be a changeup and it'll dip out of the zone. He throws everything low. So you can't as effectively lay off of it. So I like the changeup. Val from Selkirk asks, the Jays are very talented this year and last year. Both years has been a hitting problem. What about a change to hitting coach or different management? I mean, that's a question for a day that we have a little bit more time. They have tried to change some of the hitting coach stuff. Don Mattingly moved to an offensive coordinator role. They promoted Matt Hagg from AAA. Yeah, you got to look at all of these things. The hitting has turned around a little bit lately, so maybe not the best timing for this one either, but we'll keep an eye on that. We'll take a look at it maybe a day that we have a little bit more time. That's going to be all the texts we have time for today, but you can always keep them coming to 590 during the show. We'll leave them in the queue for to sprinkle them through the show to get to another day, things like that. No Blue Jays action tonight, but we'll be back with you 10 to 12 tomorrow to set up this Pirates series. Thank you to Lance Brozdowski for coming on with us, to Peter Flaherty of Baseball America, to Arden Zwelling for spending the hour with us in studio. Thanks as well to Amit Mann, Andrew Adams, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. The Jays have swept the series. Yeah, celebrate. It's the Chicago White Sox, but they swept the series. They're now just three games back of being 500. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Set up the Pirates.